Rudy and Elaine Mendez. They'd like to talk to us about the garage conversions. We get a perspective from the citizen side on this. So if you guys would like to come up, you can have 5 minutes to address the council on that.
Listen, do you mind if I speak right here?
Sure.
I'm very loud.
Yep, we can hear you.
First of all, my name is Adelina Mendez. I got nervous when my phone marked quick. You can be my boss.
Oh.
I want to tell you about my garage. We've been trying to open that garage for a long, long time. And the old person, the other, he had given us permission that we could open up the garage so we could expand. And but we weren't able to, so we kept putting it off. Now that we can, they've been telling us we can't. And I don't know why, but the whole block where I live, everybody's done it. And people that move in, what, 4 or 3 months later, they expand it. And here I've been 40 years I've lived there. And I can't do it now that it's just me that hasn't expanded. They come out and say, no, you can't. Why? My house is paid off. It's my house. I feel that I can't do nothing inside my house. I mean, really, I've been here for years. I was born and raised as an American citizen. I've never been to Mexico, and yet I have no rights. Mm-hmm. So please, I want to find out why. Oh, another thing I want to tell you guys is about the backyard of my house. They built those new buildings, which they closed me up, and they put up, we had to put up a fence. They moved our gate, put it on the other side. Now I have a whole bunch of garbage trash. I mean, trash you see chews, beer cans, any kind of trash. You see it on the side of my yard. Today, this morning, we called a policeman to go pick up a purse, a lady's purse that we found under the bush right there in my yard. And this is getting horrible. I wish somebody would go, please, clean that thing there. When it was wide open, we had it all nice and clean. And since it belongs to the city, I can't even get nobody to go out there and clean it up. In summer, it's full of weeds. And what, all the mosquitoes? You can't be outside the yard. There's too many mosquitoes out there because of the noxious weeds. And that's where you have a lot of fun. But my concern is the garage, please. I want to be able to open it. We have 2 days, 2 times that the light went out. And my whole house is connected with just electricity. And I want to be able to put a stove inside so I can at least warm up. The light went out for about 5 hours, and we got real cold. Now, I know we could have gone someplace, but really, it's my house, and it was in the morning from 7 o'clock till noon. So it was a long time. The next time, it was for about, what, an hour and a half or something like that? And I feel that we can open up the garage, put my stove in there. At least I could make breakfast and keep ourselves warm. And not worried about when the electricity was going to come back. But I want to make sure that I give you guys permission. We have never done anything that's not right with everybody else.
Well, we appreciate that. What's your phone number?
488-9807.
Okay. We'll instruct the inspector to come by again and just see you and maybe explain to you better why or why not, or maybe you can talk to him and so you can find out better what's going on. How would that work for you? And then we'll have them look at the garbage thing, too, and find out what's going on with that. So
that'll be good.
How's that?
That's great. And I hope it's a yes.
Okay. I'm not guaranteeing anything. We have to stay with the ordinance of the city. So, but we'll take a look at it. Okay?
We get an address.
Oh, what's your address?
650 Susan Place.
Susan?
Yes.
Yeah, maybe by the phone driving.
Okay.
Say again, 650.
650 Susan Place.
Okay.
Next time we're gonna find the dead people around there too.
Oh.
Oh, we don't want that, no. But thank you for coming in, okay?
Thank you for listening.
Okay. You bet. Bank of America Investment Portfolio. Alicia Bennett, I guess Mike's gonna do some.
Yes. Good evening, Mr. Mayor, members of council. We've tried to have quarterly updates from Bank of America on our investment portfolio over the years. We haven't always met that goal, but we've tried to keep close to it. And as you know, David Lee left Bank of America, and so Alicia Bennett has replaced him as our portfolio manager. And she's a portfolio manager for U.S. Trust and manages portfolios to specific objective parameters. And she has no other responsibilities other than asset management, no monthly sales goals or anything else. And she's compensated by a salary. So what she does with our investments doesn't affect her, and that makes it kind of nice. And she's been 5 years with Bank of America and 14 years in the industry. Most of that experience has been on the retail brokerage side of the business. And in September, she'll sit for the CAIA, which is a Certified Alternative Investment Analyst final level exam. And then her educational background, she has a Bachelor of Finance at Idaho State University in Pocatello, and an associate degree in computer science at Monterey Peninsula Peninsula College in Monterey, California. Alicia is very much a planner and feels like investments are simply the vehicles to achieve the overall goal. So I'm going to introduce Alicia Bennett to you tonight.
Right.
Hello, thank you for having us. It's a pleasure to get to meet all of you in person, finally. I took over for David Lee in March of this last year as he left the firm, and I work closely with Ann Sultanic, who has been a part of, she's the private client advisor for the portfolio, and then I manage the portfolios. And we have a lot of business in this area and spend a much more time over here, so I think it makes a lot more sense, and hopefully I can get over here more often to meet that goal of quarterly meetings. And so I guess with all of my background, give you guys a view of that, step back and give you kind of an economic update of where we've been, then maybe a view of what we see going forward, and then what we'll need to do is reevaluate, and I'll get some feedback from Mike, what your needs are looking forward. Are there any projects planned? Because at the end of the day, we have an awful lot of the portfolio that's coming due for reinvestment in 2010. So before I get too far ahead of myself, step back and let's economic overview. A little over a year, we were in the midst of the financial crisis, which was a complete disorder in the global financial world. They liken it, I like the illustration of a car wreck, of two giant trucks in a main intersection of a city that blocked the intersection. And nobody can get around them. Everybody stopped at every other intersection, and it backs up for miles because nobody can get through until they can figure out what this mess is here to get everything out of the way. And that's kind of, you know, in a very simplistic form, you know, what we saw happen in the financial world. And it plunged us into a full-on recession like we haven't seen since the 30s. And before I get too far into that, if there's anything that anybody wants to go into more detail, because I don't want to take up a bunch of your time, but more than happy to go into any detail on economic events, the portfolio, but I'm going to do a kind of a brief overview in light of your full agenda for the evening, I'm sure. So where are we now? So here we are a year and a half out of the crisis. We've seen a good recovery in the equity markets. We see the economy following behind. We just got a read on GDP at 5.7% growth. So we're chugging along, but it's very, very fragile. We are sitting at essentially zero Fed rates for interest rates, And we don't see that changing anytime soon. You know, the Fed won't start to raise rates until they see significant signs of economic improvement, which means jobs. We think they're coming. We think there's a lot of economic indicators that say, yes, productivity for corporate America is at an all-time high. That we've got manufacturing improving, we've got the temporary employment, which tends to be a leader for unemployment, has been rising for the last 6 months. So it says, you know, all of our indicators say jobs growth is around the corner, but again, we know it's going to be very, very slow, which for you, what that means to you and your portfolio is we're coming up on reinvestment for $1.6 million in the next year with very low interest rates. And we've seen such a flight to quality because everybody's been so afraid of the equity markets that they flood to the bonds. So we're sitting, you know, we've had a very good year. Through this last year, we're getting, you know, we're the last page of your, don't jump to the performance, but essentially, the portfolio is yielding 4.4% overall right now. We've got $122,000 worth of cash just on hand right now. We've got bonds starting to mature come February 9th. We've got $200,000 coming due in February. Then it will start to, you know, start the cycle, and we'll have about $200,000 coming due every single month. What I want to know before we, you know, make a next step with that is, are we going to need any of that? How long of a time frame can we look at to reinvest that? Our ladder, we've got a ladder structured so that we've always got money coming due, and so that when we reinvest, we can go out a little further on that ladder to get as best interest rate as we possibly can, but it's only going out until 2015. So it's a 5-year window, which again leaves us with pretty low interest rates. So those are the biggest risks facing this portfolio, the reinvestment risk and the purchasing power risk. So with that, so if you look to, so under tab one, you've got economic update. If you want to go through kind of more in detail what the numbers are driving, under tab two gives you the overall breakdown, the total portfolio amount, the cost, what it's valued at now, estimated income, and current yield. Then the next page gives you the breakdown of, okay, what's the breakdown of that? How much of that is in U.S. governments? How much of that is in agencies? How much of that is in mutual funds? Then on the next page, it gives us the, I think the most critical point in the portfolio right now is the maturity schedule. Again, 0 to 1 year, almost 71% of this portfolio is coming up for reinvestment. And so, you know, essentially what we want to do is very carefully navigate the environment that we find ourselves in. We're finding rising interest rates tends to have a negative effect on bond prices. It's okay as long as we reinvest and we're going to maturity, it doesn't affect us as much, but we're also looking at rising fears of inflation, not necessarily immediately, but looking 24 months out. We don't see rates coming up 24 months out, rising inflation 24 months out. So we've got reinvestment and pricing risk. So those are the two things that we are struggling to mitigate for you. So with reinvesting on a 10-year treasury is 3.6. The danger in going out that far is probably by next year at this time, we're looking at a treasury paying 4.3. So it would have a negative impact on the price. So we would come back down to a shorter maturity, which leaves us in the 0.8% on a 2-year treasury, right? And so agencies, we can get a little better rate on agencies, and in the pooled investments, we can get a little better rate, but we'll probably reduce those as well because they tend to be a little bit more subject to interest rate risk. So it's, you know, again, we've done extraordinarily well this past year. We're at, you know, 4.5% year over year, but next year I don't think, you know, I could see that coming to, you know, cut in half potentially. But so, you know, essentially what we want to do is mitigate that, and right as of now, depending on the schedule of maybe any use of the funds, continue on that ladder to to go out maybe 5 years, utilize tips. We utilize tips to try and protect our purchasing power. So they're inflation protected. So they take that base amount, apply the CPI number, and inflate that amount by inflation, and then apply the interest rate to that inflated amount. So that's one way that we use to mitigate that risk, and they're paying about 3.5. So our first round of bonds, that would be the suggested place for it. But I can't put everything in TIPS, so that's kind of the balance. So, you know, as of now, and again, I'll look to Mike for the utilization schedule and look to maybe be out here a little more often to keep you updated so that you have a better handle on, you know, where we are, and I have a better handle on what you'd like to see from us. So with that, questions, we've got the whole portfolio. Yeah, and then the very last page is the performance, the end all, you know, against benchmarks. What have we done against our long-term benchmarks? And this is where we're measured against. So if we look at 12-month performance, so 12-month performance, we're at 2.7% positive yield, and that takes into account the yield and any appreciation on the bonds. And then for 24 months, so through this whole crisis period, we're at 4.17. So again, we've done very well in the past. Maintaining the results are going to be a little more challenging in the future, but we'll do our very, very best. And there's some funds that yield a little better, but again, there's a danger there because as interest rates come up, the value of those come down, and so we don't want to see any of that fluctuation either. So, so we've done extraordinarily well. It's good and something to be celebrated that we've done very well. But looking forward again, it's going to be a little bit more of a challenge. Are there any questions, any other things that you want to go into more detail about? And again, I'll follow up with Mike on, you know, looking forward, where is there any of this that we need to set aside for maybe, you know, maybe 1 year, maybe 2 years out? I want to maintain liquidity and not lock anything up, but, you know, not leave it sitting there if it isn't going to be used either.
So it sounds like you're saying if it goes the wrong direction, we could lose money.
Potentially, yeah. So that's why, you know, we'll lighten up. So we've done well this last year with some funds because they've come up in value because rates, you know, as rates go down, prices go up.
And when you say lose money, since you've got a bond ladder, the value of the bonds are going to go up and down.
Right.
If interest rates go up, the value of the bonds go down. But they mature up at par. So you buy them and then they mature at par. They may move in between here and there. The risk is if you need cash and we need to sell those bonds before they mature, you may be selling them for less than what you bought them. And that's why this cash planning that Alicia's been talking about is so critical for you to have a successful portfolio. As long as we make sure that we know what your cash needs are, kind of in the 12 to 24 month time frame, she can make sure that she's got that cash ready for you so that she doesn't have to sell a longer term bond at a disadvantageous way for you. And so that's why it's important to keep the ladder in place so that we're always extending out onto that higher yield curve as it goes up higher, but that she's got cash available for you. So those are kind of the two things that she's going to work this year to balance out as all of that money matures into this very low interest rate environment.
Yeah.
Any questions from council?
On the last page on tab 2 where it has your performance, could you go in a little detail about the real estate and tangible assets? Because as I'm reading it, we've only been into it the last 3 months and they've done very well.
Yes, and those are kind of some pieces to help protect your purchasing power. You know, we've got commodities that are, it's a little tiny piece, but it helps as inflation goes up, it rises in prices and kind of offsets a little bit. But in a portfolio like this, we want to be very, very careful to keep that to a, you know, a very minimum amount.
What is the Wilshire real estate? Is that like stocks or interest or what is
that? That's the index. So that's the index. The Wilshire real estate is the index that it's measuring against. The real estate is a mutual fund.
Tied to?
So tied to that index, essentially. So it's an index.
I mean, so what is that mutual fund investing in?
Into underlying REITs.
Into what?
Underlying REITs.
Real estate
investment trust. Right. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes. I'm sorry. Take that for, yeah. So essentially, it's kind of a, you know, again, just a purchasing power protective mechanism, but it needs to be, you know, kept at a minimum.
Well, tied to real estate, isn't that one that you potentially lose quite a bit of principal?
Potentially, and that's why we keep it in a very conservative, but, you know, and to offset the other potential loss of values. It's definitely an art of balancing that out.
The real estate investment trust, what they do is they give you a very broad diversification against various areas in the real estate market. And so what she's done by adding that to the portfolio in such a recent time, where we've seen the big downturn in the overall real estate market across the entire country, you're seeing the benefit of those rising prices. So that's what's being reflected right there.
Right.
It's not some of the, you know, crazy things that you hear about with,
right,
you know, prime, subprime mortgages or anything like that. It really is a very broadly diversified real estate mutual fund that
and it also pays out, it's about a 6% dividend yield. So it kind of balances out that the lower yield. But again, we need to keep it at, I think it's under 3%. We are at a 2% position, but we need to keep it at that level. So
should we be looking at a mutual fund in stocks, or is that legal for a municipal investment?
That's something that we need to address, because we're approaching this from a very short-term investment view. And maybe that's not appropriate.
Yeah,
maybe it
so
needs to be extended.
Yeah, looking at, we're going to look at the RCWs, but I think mutual fund and stocks is not going to fit with your requirements.
Because they've done real well in 2009, and as of late, they're kind of volatile, but they had a good year.
And as we look forward, just, you know, an overall view, as we look into 2010, yes, we've had a V-shaped recovery in the equity markets in 2009, and we think now it's kind of a square root where it's going to level out. But the companies that will see the next wave of that recovery are going to be those higher quality, dividend-paying, more mature companies that didn't do as well last year, because those quick recoveries tend to take the lower quality companies, higher beta, that are, you know, that mature in higher multiples to the market. Last year, those companies were in favor. This year, those more solid dividend-paying companies are definitely in favor. You know, in an overall scheme, yes, it would be, you know, if you look at from the standpoint of investing in a bond versus a stock. So let's say GE. GE is a AAA-rated credit quality company. We could buy a GE bond, and I think for a five-year term, we could get 3.8. We could buy GE stock and get almost a 3% dividend yield with some upside potential, with arguably, you know, similar risk parameters. You know, so that's a, I mean, it's a big discussion, but that's one of the things, you know, again, that we talked about looking at this portfolio.
This portfolio has got a fixed income, short-term, fairly short-term objectives, and so that gives us over, and plus there's the extra rules and regulations that the state overlays on that. So it gives us a real limit in the types of things that we can look at to invest in to kind of offset this low interest rate and inflationary risk that you're looking at going forward. So it's kind of the things that we can select are fairly limited, and we have to be careful about that.
Well, I think the way the economy is, and if we don't actually know how much we're going to be pulling out and we have things coming due, isn't just going to cash the best way to preserve principal?
In my eyes, it is, yes. I really do think that, because like I said, we've got 70% of this portfolio coming due within 12 months, so that extends into early 2011, but it's a large proportion of it, and yeah, interest rates are going to come up. We think it'll be slow. You know, that's the trade-off, and that's something that we very carefully pencil out. Okay, what's the risk of leaving it in essentially a cash equivalent earning, you know, near your, you know, 0.2, 0.5 versus investing it in a bond that may fluctuate in value and then locking it up. But I definitely feel that the first piece, I think we're underweight in tips. We have some room where we can add to tips, and I think that's a good move where, again, we're inflation protected. It's still a government bond, and it's paying 3.5%. But for the next $200,000 that's coming due in March, we're looking at, you know, possibly September for the first rise in rates, which will probably be, you know, 25 basis points. So it will depend on, you know, as we look at rates, the treasuries are going to lead on as far as rates. We see the treasury coming up to, you know, the 10-year treasury. Right now it's paying 3.6. We see 4, maybe potentially by the end of the year. So, okay, you know, depending on the economy, if the economy recovers as quickly as it is on pace to recover, maybe we see that more sooner than later. And if that's the case, then maybe we wait 1, 2 months, 3 months, let that money accumulate and be able to continue our ladder and not, you know, be hurt by that. But again,
there's
a lot to be told.
Keeping your investment ladder in place, and you can play a little bit with how long you go out,
right,
how short you keep it. You don't want to go out too long. But as long as you keep your ladder constantly rolling in place and you don't have a big need for cash coming up, that gives you a really interest rate neutral strategy. If interest rates go up, you win because you've got short-term maturities that you're going to be reinvesting in those higher interest rates.
Right.
But if interest rates don't go up, if we do kind of continue to see a more violent economy, you're not keeping all the money at that 0.2% in cash. You continue to invest it and try to grab as much of the 2%, 3% kind of yields,
right,
that you want to get. So you want to balance out both those pieces and kind of keeping that ladder within place. But keeping the cash available is going to be your best strategy to play out the next 12 to 24 months.
And it looks like we've got, so we have $500,000 coming due between now and April. So that's kind of the big piece, and then there's a little lag in the window. And like I said, we could do $200,000 with tips without, I think that's appropriate. So maybe that next $300,000, we wait a couple of months to see where that economy is going to lie, and 2 or 3 months isn't going to, you know, affect us either way in a yield and may protect us. So at that point, then, you know, we reevaluate, or maybe that's money that is needed for some project that we want to earmark as well. So a couple of questions, I think, to pose and come back to, and then I guess follow up with, okay, based on those answers, here's what, you know, we would suggest to do with those funds.
How often do you actually look at this portfolio, this one personally?
Quite often.
Every week you look at it, or?
I would say probably every couple of weeks. I'd say probably a 2 week schedule, and more so recently, as you know, obviously we've got the maturity schedule, so we, you know, always look to see what the maturities are coming up in the next 30 days. But also, you know, we've got the real estate and we've got the commodities, and actually reduced that amount recently because we had a pullback in commodities, and you know, we at the beginning of the year they'd done very well, but pulled that some of that off the table, so that's been reduced as well. So I'd say, you know, in the last 2 to 3 months, weekly.
Any questions for council?
And I'd look forward to coming back and seeing all of you. And
well, thank you, Alicia, and the two of you for coming. We appreciate it.
It's
a drive over the mountain. So
it's a, yeah. It's
drive careful
so
going back.
We're actually flying tomorrow morning. So.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Thank you.
status, status report. Green Osborne, Nancy, and I assume Larry's going to be involved.
Well, I just wanted to introduce Nancy Ward here. Some of you may recall she has been council before. Nancy is in our wastewater group, one of our wastewater gurus in the AMMA office. Has quite a bit of knowledge, has been working extensively with the Department of Ecology on the MPPDS permit. That city is in the process of getting renewed at this time.
What does NPDES mean?
National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System.
Darn an echo here. All right.
I'm sorry, Gene, you felt
we will further define that.
I didn't know what it was.
It's a fancy initials for the permit that you need to have in order to discharge effluent from the treatment plant. It also governs the entire collection system. Pump stations, pipelines, treatment plants, anything that's called a POTW, publicly owned treatment works, has answers to the permit. And in the permit will be requirements the city has to follow as far as routine reporting, as well as specialty reports, and limitations. Potentially we'll be getting into that.
Good evening. As Larry said, I'm Nancy Mortar, and I'm with the Yakima Wastewater Group. Green Osborne's divided into groups depending on your discipline. You've heard from our transportation group and utilities, and I'm in the wastewater group. Just to give you a little background on our group to make sure that we are legitimate in what we do, my group has about 15 process engineers split between our four or five offices. In the last 10 years, we've planned, designed, constructed different phases, different treatment plants, about 35 wastewater treatment plants in the last 10 years. Lots of your neighbors, west side, north, south. The smallest treatment plant we've done is 61,000 gallons per day. But I actually take that back. I looked today and we'd actually done even smaller. The largest being Puyallup at 14 million gallons per day. And you're actually the size of city we work for, you know, 2 million gallons a day. You're very common size, if you want to say that. My goal here today is just to give you a summary of where your wastewater is, where you might be going, where the state's going. This is to be very brief, and but it can be as in-depth as you want. So if you want to ask questions, just go ahead and ask them. I can get more in-depth. We're going to cover what your wastewater treatment is, where wastewater regulations and permits come from, your permit, where we think that you're going in the future with your wastewater treatment, where the state of Washington's going, and where the city could go from here as far as your next 5 years. We think of wastewater treatment in some ways in terms of 5 years because this permit that we've been talking about is a five-year permit. So your first wastewater treatment plant was built in 1955, and it was a little mechanical plant out on Cunningham Road. If you go out there, you'll see little rustic formations of old tanks out there. And, in 1963, they built the lagoon system that's out there now. And over the years, 1981, they built some additional lagoons. 1992 had some minor upgrades. But overall, the amount of upgrades that you have done to your treatment plant are fairly limited because you have a facultative lagoon system, which is a very forgiving system. Essentially, a facultative lagoon, you have, I believe, it's almost 50 acres of lagoon out there. The wastewater comes in, you have this very long detention time in most lagoons, and then it's discharged to the creek. A facultative lagoon is not aerated, nothing happens to it. It's just a silent pond, essentially. And there are different layers in that pond, and those different layers treat your wastewater and break it down into nutrients that are not harmful to the environment, essentially. You discharge to Owl Creek, which is a tributary to Lower Crab Creek, and that's kind of key to part of my presentation. And you're permitted by your NPDES permit number, and WA002235, and that's issued and regulated by the Department of Ecology in Washington State. So this is the Google view, I guess you could say, of your treatment plant at the end of Cunningham Road. Essentially, your wastewater comes down Cunningham Road, goes down this sort of, there's a little channel here, then it goes into these ponds and essentially makes its way out to Owl Creek. Owl Creek is just a small very slow flowing creek. I was out there this summer, and it does flow year round, which is key. I think it flows year round. Your permit says it flows year round. And then you have a little operations building out here where they do all the lab testing. So in the scope of wastewater treatment, you have about, for the size of your town, you have the simplest form of wastewater treatment that you could have. So I wanted to talk a little bit about wastewater regulations and where they come from. This might be kind of repetitive for some of you that have been around the city for a while, but essentially wastewater regulations started in 1972 when they passed the Clean Water Act. And it was basically the basis for all water quality in the United States. It set up what water quality standards would be for all rivers, lakes, estuaries, coastal waters, wetlands, anything that was a government water. Basically, they set some standards for which everybody had to be held to so that we weren't polluting our waters, and they basically were getting on top of a problem that probably started centuries before that. The Clean Water Act is where the issuance of the NPDES program came along. National Pollution Discharge Elimination System. So it was, Clean Water Act put this tool in place that allows, if you discharge into a river of the government, or a creek, or a lake, it is the vehicle for which you are regulated. It only regulates point source discharges, and by that I mean, I always think of that, you can actually walk up to a pipe and say, that's what's going in the creek. A non-point source discharge may be irrigation, drainage, wasteway, that type of thing. Most NPDES are municipalities, as you can imagine. It's a point source, it's a pipe going in a river that has a permit associated with it. And it basically allows you to discharge a certain amount of pollutants into that river. Most NPDES permit programs are administered at the state level. In Washington, that's Department of Ecology. That's who you answer to. Your Department of Ecology for water quality is out of Spokane. You're considered the eastern region over here. Washington administers their water quality standards. So they set up some water quality standards for Washington State. EPA, though, still oversees those, and still Washington State still has to run these by EPA, essentially. So EPA is still out there saying, Washington State, are you administering your program? What are your water quality standards? There's still, you'll still hear of places that are administered directly by EPA. And those include the state of Idaho, Alaska, military bases, anything that's a federal. Many tribes do not have their own water quality, so EPA still regulates the tribal level. You're regulated at the state level. If you ask me which one you want to be, I can't tell you, because we have both types of clients that have EPA regulations and ecology regulations. They essentially mirror each other, but one is federal government and one's at the state level. And you are administered at the state level. So what's your NTDS permit? It authorizes discharge to Owl Creek, which is a tributary to Lower Crab Creek. Your new permit, in fact, I snagged it on the way over here, is going to be issued, I put January and February, but obviously we're past January and February. And I'm not sure if they indicated when you're going to get your new permit, but we've been working for the past 6 months reviewing this permit. What Ecology does is they draft up this permit based on an application that the city submits, and then they send it out for factual review, and we assist the city in reviewing it, and we send back comments, and it goes through several iterations, and then they issue it. We sent back the last comments in early January. They issued us a letter January 22nd. I'm not exactly sure when your new permit will be issued. What essentially happens, though, is your old permit's still in place until the new permit comes online. So sometime probably in February, maybe March. And it has gone through a public comment period. So this was advertised probably in your local paper that the public could have commented on this. It allows discharge of pollutants consistent with the permit conditions. So in here it says you can discharge certain pollutants to Owl Creek, but it has to be within what we say. And usually that's in terms of pounds of a certain nutrient or a certain concentration of something. We'll get into that a little bit. So the permit has effluent limits. It has all kinds of things in it. Your mixing zone analysis, monitoring requirements. You're required to monitor the creek. You're required to monitor your ponds. And it also has submittal and reporting requirements. So what pollutants do we talk about? When I say pollutants, biochemical oxygen demand, and this is kind of a hard one to explain. We term it as just BOD, but it's essentially the measurement of organic content. So you have all, you have organic substances going out to the creek that are basically gobbling up all the oxygen, and it's not just one compound, it's actually a measurement of something, but I usually tell people just think of it as another compound, a nutrient that you don't want in your wastewater. So it's one of the pollutants that you are allowed to discharge, but you're only allowed to discharge a certain amount. Total suspended solids is just suspended matter. It can be, I mean, just think of dirty water. Shake up a jar of dirty water and whatever's floating in there. It can be inerts, organics. It's exactly what we mean, total suspended solids. We don't want to be discharging murky water into your pristine creek. Other pollutants we talk about is ammonia, which is a compound of nitrogen and hydrogen, and it's toxic to aquatic life. So you are depleting oxygen levels in the receiving water. Essentially, all rivers and streams, lakes need a certain amount of oxygen so that the fish and the plants can all live. Other pollutants include total nitrogen and phosphorus. This is kind of a fancy way of saying excess nitrogen and phosphorus speed up eutrophication, which is just basically kind of like fertilizing the water. So what you're doing is you're adding a substance that's promoting algae. Algae depletes oxygen in the water. And essentially, you're basically just throwing the whole ecosystem of your creek out of whack if you put too much nitrogen and phosphorus in it. I mean, that's the very non-scientific way of saying that, but it's essentially kind of like fertilizing the water. The final one I threw on here was priority pollutants. So your Clean Water Act identifies 126 chemicals, and some of these are included in here, but it includes metals, and actually I believe you even have to run a test in your permit once throughout the life cycle of the permit. I think you did have to do this the last time. That looks at all 126 chemicals to see if there is anything that raises red flags. For the most part, you are just a regular old municipality. You have little industry that goes in there. You're not one of these. We deal with some clients that, for instance, have silicon wafer dischargers, food processor discharges, things like that. For the most part, I know you do have a little bit of industry here, but for the most part, you're just regular old municipal wastewater with some commercial restaurants and things like that. So that is very much to your advantage. You don't have anything in your wastewater that raises huge red flags beyond any other community. So your discharge permit says that, so in your permit you'll find these effluent limits, and it says that you can discharge 390 pounds per day of BOD on an average monthly basis. Total suspended solids have the same discharge. Fecal coliform is the bacteria found in all mammals, and that is the one that is harmful to you and me. So that's the one, if you were discharging into a highly recreational water, there's a lot of boating, fishing, or if you were upstream of a drinking water intake, fecal coliform is the one that we really worry about as humans. pH, between your limit is between 6 and 9, water is at 7. So these are the effluent limits that are in your current permit. There were three new limits in the permit that's coming out now, and that's these metal limits, copper, nickel, and zinc. We don't believe that they're a problem for you at this time, but these are, it is interesting that you have metals limits and you don't have other limits, but these are there. We don't think they're a problem at this time. We think that your treatment plant can handle them, but there are treatment plants in the state that have issues with copper, nickel, and zinc. Your lagoon system's pretty forgiving for these types of things. It's not good for other pollutants, but for these types of things, it can be forgiving. So what's new in your permit, or what's in your permit, is you have these new metals limits. You do have to continue to watch to monitor the stream. So what they're having you do is they're having you go upstream of the discharge and take a bunch of samples of the creek, and then they have your operators go downstream and take a bunch of samples. What they're trying to get is they're trying to get background information on your creek. What they will use that in the future. They will use that in the future to determine your future permit limits. So right now you're in a big gathering information stage, and they had to do this in the previous permit as well. Also in your permit is, you have to work on an ordinance, You have a small issue with total spent solids coming into the treatment plant. So there's a few other compliance reports that are in your current permit that we are addressing. Really nothing out of the ordinary, except for those new metals limits, and I'll get into that a little bit. What isn't in your permit, and is very important, is that you don't have an ammonia limit, you don't have a total nitrogen limit, and you don't have a phosphorus limit. Those are three items that we had fully expected ecology might raise red flags to ecology. They did not come around, and those, I can tell you right now, those limits would be a deal breaker for a lagoon system. Lagoon systems are very forgiving until you get to these types of limits, and then there's really, you really have to go to a mechanical treatment plant at that point. Ecology did not impose these limits at this time. We had fully expected, and we had talked about strategies that were going into the future of your wastewater treatment plant, basically based on having an ammonia limit. Now, total nitrogen limits and phosphorus limits, I brought those up. They're important, but we are not seeing those across the state for surface water quality. Well, it's coming. The Spokane River, anybody that discharges into the Spokane River is looking at total nitrogen and phosphorus limits. It's a huge topic up there for Spokane. In fact, you'll read in the Spokesman Review all kinds of things about ordinance preventing, you know, people using, well, now it's statewide, but people preventing the use of soap that had phosphorus in it. And you read all kinds of things about how much they're spending on their treatment plant up there. And it more or less has to do with phosphorus limits up there. If they're starting in one spot of the state, it just moves around. Right now, in fact, I just met with a client today that's looking at the Wenatchee area. The Wenatchee River TMDL set phosphorus limits. So although I put total nitrogen and phosphorus on here, I only know of a couple plants that have those limits, but they're coming. They just, it takes a long time to do these projects, and once they come to one part of the state, it moves through the state, and eventually the whole state catches up to those types of limits. Ammonia limits are pretty common, and that's fully the one that we expected. However, you did not get that limit in this round of permits. So your current status is you have a new permit issued this February or maybe March. You generally comply with your current permit, so you're not in trouble with anybody at this point as far as, I think generally ecology seems pretty happy with what you do. They are a little concerned because you receive more total suspended solids into your treatment plant than what all the documentation says that you can receive. For instance, your permit says every day Othello should be able to receive 2 million gallons of wastewater that has a total suspended solids of 2,600 pounds. Now, the thing with a lagoon system is that total suspended solids isn't a huge thing because, once again, it's kind of a forgiving system for that type of thing. You have several days of detention to settle out solids. You do have some issue with coliforms, but a lot of that's due to the fact that you have 50 acres of fabulous waterfowl area out there. So you have problems with the waterfowl. I believe that that's probably most of your coliform issues. I don't know what you do. I mean, you have 50 acres of lagoons and lots of ducks. You know, it's just a very tough thing to mitigate. They do use chlorine out there. Chlorine obviously will kill the coliform, but you also have a chlorine limit. So they do have, and because of the lagoons, you do have huge algae growth. You saw in that previous picture, there's a big white spot on one of the lagoons, and I took that picture off of the internet, and I think that big white spot is a big algae bloom. And so on the picture, instead of appearing sort of like this dark blue or black water, it turns white with algae. And I think that algae overgrowth in the summertime, you're discharging total suspended solids go up. Once again, the city has tried several things to control algae growth. I think one of the things they tried this year was there's some theory and some evidence that if you put straw out there that the straw can help you control the algae growth. But essentially, when you have 50 acres of lagoons, that's a pretty difficult thing to control. But generally, I mean, for wastewater treatment, you guys are, I think ecology is generally pretty happy with you. You do have those new metals limits, which I think you're okay with. You have to continue to do the water quality monitoring that they've been doing for years. Your new permit, so this is a 5-year cycle. We expect your new permit to be issued in 2015. We We don't know what the requirements will be at that time. When I say nutrient removal, that's the nitrogen, phosphorus, ammonia issue. We would full-on expect at that time that definitely ammonia removal could be in the works. When those types of things come around, though, ecology has to give you a compliance deadline. So they can't turn around and issue a permit in February that says, you know, you have to meet the ammonia deadline now. They are required to give you a compliance deadline. Usually it's, and that's part of our job as your consultant, is to help you make sure ecology is following their own rules, making sure they do give you compliance deadline and that they're realistic. You don't do wastewater projects overnight of that type of magnitude. It's interesting to know where the state's going, because, like I said, what's happening in other parts of the state is going to happen here eventually. Regulations are not relaxing. Surprise, surprise. It's interesting. The state actually commissioned a company to do to evaluate. They commissioned a consultant to do a statewide study. How much money would it cost to make every treatment plant in Washington State be able to comply with nutrient removal, the nitrogen, phosphorus, and ammonia? I don't believe that study is complete, but if they're looking at it, that means that they're looking at imposing it everywhere. So we've even received some correspondence about other projects where we're doing facility plans for cities, and the ecology personnel are saying, well, you may want to look one step further because we are doing this study. So not only have I seen reports of this study, I've actually been told in formal correspondence that they are doing this study and that they want everybody to consider nutrient removal in their next upgrade. There's total maximum daily load studies are being done all the time. Spokane River, and what total maximum daily load is, they basically look at a nutrient in that river that may be causing problems. They study it. They find out how much that river can handle. So this river can handle so many pounds of phosphorus. This river can handle so much of an increase in temperature. And then they go to each point source and they say, okay, Spokane, you can only discharge 2 pounds of phosphorus. Okay, Coeur d'Alene, you can only discharge 3 pounds of phosphorus. So TMDL, that's a very simplistic review of a TMDL. TMDL studies are years long, and ecology puts a lot of effort into these to basically evaluate rivers and streams to find out maximum daily loads for anything that could be a problem, pH. The one I was discussing today in Wenatchee's is actually not a phosphorus TMDL, it's a pH TMDL, but pH is affected by phosphorus, so it's all, it gets very convoluted. Yakima River is doing a TMDL here in the next 5 or 6 years. Whether that will be what triggered, I doubt that's what triggers your issue, but it's just that these are things that are leading in the state. Leads in the state, it's coming your direction. Third-party lawsuits. See them a lot. You do occasionally violate your permit. The Clean Water Act gives third parties the right to sue anybody that violates their permit, that has an NPDES permit. So there are several environmental groups, and these are the two that came to mind that I've dealt with, Columbia River Creeper and Waste Action Project, and you can Google them. They are environmental groups that target violators, municipalities, industries that violate their permits. I have seen them sue people in the Crab Creek watershed. I was going to look this up before I came tonight, but Crab Creek is one of these, something like the longest creek in the United States or something like that, or the biggest watershed in the United States or something. It has some kind of, you know, maybe some of you guys know, it has its own infamous title to it. So it's a watched creek, I guess you could say. Just like the Columbia River, of course, it's a very watched watershed. So Crab Creek has been looked at by Waste Action Project. So you're not in line for, I don't believe that, you know, you would pop up on any of these radars for third-party lawsuits. I'm just bringing the reality that there is this mechanism out there. If you do violate your permit, there's this mechanism for a third party to get involved. I thought I'd just throw out what other cities are facing, just so you can kind of see what's going on around in the state. If you have noncompliance, ecology can enforce fines. I hardly ever see that. I mean, who's going to fine a city? I mean, I shouldn't say it so simply, but really, they don't want you to pay the money to them. They want you to put your money into your treatment plant. But they do have that mechanism out there, and I've seen it done at one municipality where they actually fine a municipality for sewer violations or for permit violations. The real big thing for communities like yours is, say you had a wastewater issue and you weren't complying with your permit, but are sewer moratoriums. I mean, that would halt your development if they came along and said, till you fix your wastewater problems, you can't hook any more people up to your sewer system. And that has happened to a few communities that we know of, and it's devastating in a time when you're really looking at some good development. The third-party lawsuits that I discussed, I just happened to Google Waste Action Project because I wanted to get a really good background on them. They're actually kind of difficult to find information on. I did find an article in the Spokesman Review that was from a couple years ago that said they had 9 lawsuits in central and eastern Washington, and those are just some of the communities that came up. Wilbur was Little Wilbur that discharges into, I can't think of the creek now, it's like Rose Creek or something that goes into the Crab Creek watershed. They are being sued by Waste Action Project. You wouldn't think that they would arise up on anybody's radar. So these are what other cities are facing. I think you're in a very good position, but this is what's going on in the state. I threw in here a couple of just things that we've seen just to give you a magnitude of some of the projects we're seeing for wastewater. The city of Toppenish, they had what we call an SBC, RBC process. It's just a technology for treating wastewater. They had to do a major upgrade to the tune of about $14 million. The driving force was ammonia limits, and they had some reliability and redundancy issues. But their driving force was they were imposed pretty strict ammonia limits. Raymond South Bend, they, interestingly enough, have facultative lagoons very similar to yours. They are doing a new project to the cost of about $25 million. The driving force for them was TMDLs, the nutrient limits, and a lawsuit by Waste Action Project. Your neighbor, the city of Warden, they're in a little bit different situation. They don't have an NPDES permit, but I threw them out here so that you would see what some of your neighbors are doing. They just did a project for a reclaimed water plant to the tune of about $10 million. And their driving force was they actually discharged to ground, and they were basically being accused of contaminating groundwater. A little bit different situation and different set of regulations than going to a creek, surface water. So these wastewater treatment facility capital improvement projects, the steps here are to go through, we call them a three-step project. All of these communities that I just showed you went through three-step projects, planning, pretty basic planning documents where we go through all of the city's existing planning and look at where you're going in the future, and we try to prove the wastewater plan for you. Ecology has to approve this plan, and then you go for funding. Now, these are just typical steps that a wastewater project goes through. Step 2 is generally the design documents, contract development. Once again, Ecology has to approve those. We go for construction funding. Bid the project, then you get to actually construct what you're doing. So a three-step project. Ecology, once again, has to even accept your construction. So they are continuing to oversee a wastewater project. The final result that we want for all of our clients is compliance with their NPDES, because that is the essential part of where you need to go to continue to grow your community and prosper and develop. You need infrastructure. This is one piece of that infrastructure that you have to comply with this permit. Of course, everybody wants to know who funds this stuff. Very similar to a lot of the other funding programs that have probably been thrown in front of you, community development block grant, rural development. These are kind of the standard funding things. Larry and I were discussing. Definitely, if your community is associated with any economic development, you could go for economic development funds, low interest loans through Ecology, Public Works Trust Fund, which is, of course, not existent this year. Rural Development does loans. We have communities that go for federal funding through the state tribal assistance program or grant program. So there's lots of avenues, but you definitely have to put your feet on the ground and really work for it. Funding qualifications, it all goes back to, how do these funding programs work? And I just kind of threw up a few things so that you knew what you're facing when you're going to funding. So some of the programs look at your current rates and they compare them to other cities. rates as a percentage of your median household income. So they take a look at your census, and they go to your median household income, and they say, well, your sewer rate should at least be 2% of your median household income. And I was going to look and see what your median household income is. But it's very surprising. When I first started at Grant Osborne, Ecology used to say, I think it was 1% or 1.5% of your median household income. They have raised that up to, now they have a step, and you have to be up to almost 3% of your median household income before you get a break in some of this financing. Other things that are looked at, obviously the medium household income, which will become important because census is coming up. Current economic growth, and that goes back to some of those economic development type grants and things that you could be eligible if you can prove, you know, that your economy is tied to it. Low to moderate income status, that goes back to housing and urban development, CTED type funding. Your permit compliance, unfortunately, the more out of compliance you are, the better funding you get. It's just the way it works. You almost are better, unfortunately that is, you're almost better rewarded the worse shape you're in. Compliance orders and lawsuits. You say you have a lawsuit and you throw that in front of them, and that helps you out a lot. Or a severe human health hazard. For instance, the city of Natchez discharges like 5 or 6 miles upstream from the Yakima water treatment plant. And let's say they were having some severe issues. That might be a severe human health hazard because there's a water treatment plant, a potable water treatment plant right there nearby. You know, we kind of somewhat joke in the office, you know, if there's dead and dying people, you're going to get funded. Sad, but that's definitely the ones that if you're under a compliance order, you have permit problems, you have a severe human health hazard, you kind of fly to the top of the list. I threw this, this is a really difficult slide to read, but I threw this slide on here. We just did this last week for a client. What I wanted to show here was basically how long it takes to do these projects. I know that you're looking at some projects for your SR24 and overlays on Main Street and stuff, and those projects are generally done year to year. Wastewater projects, in the worst case scenario, for instance, this particular client started applying for facility plans. So that's just that step one phase in late 2010. They didn't really get anything constructed until 2016. A lot of that's driven by these funding cycles. So you can only apply for funds. Most funding you can only apply for once a year. So you got to have everything lined up, and then you know the next funding cycle comes around, and it can be a game somewhat to be able to navigate your way around there and make sure that your planning and your everything is just falling in line. Now this was a worst case scenario for this particular client, and I can tell you this is a pretty small town, probably smaller than Othello. This was another scenario where you know they did things maybe a bit differently, and they got done from 2010 to 2015. I just wanted to show you that these are not the typical utility or road projects. These tend to be longer projects just because of the size, the magnitude, and the regulations that go with them. I handed out this little report, and if you want some good bedtime reading and need to go to sleep, you might just glance through it. I thought it was interesting because it was a report done by Ecology regarding basically small communities in their wastewater. I flagged two things in there that I thought you might find of interest, so you could just quickly glance to those. This was just something that I actually found on Ecology's website. I'm on Ecology's website every single day and did not know this report existed, which is difficult because we're out here trying to help all these communities, and they're doing these reports, and I felt like they need to make them available to you guys as well, or your city administration. But it's just a report about, I think there's examples of about 10 small communities in there. In fact, I was the designer of one of those treatment plants. And it just shows what those communities faced. It was done for the legislature by the Department of Ecology. I'm not exactly sure what the goal was other than to say, you know, we need a lot more money in wastewater if you really want to uphold the regulations that EPA's put on the state. One thing I found of interest, this is one of the flags, and this is a very difficult flag to read, so if you want to open to your flag, but if you're curious about, you know, where your sewer rates are in comparison to the rest of the state, this is just kind of an interesting one to look at. This says they're 1768. I don't know if that's still true. This was in 2008. But the mean for the state was around 3752, and I think there was something like this is communities under a certain population, so you'd actually have to read that particular page. I couldn't get it all on the slide. But you might just look through here and see there are some communities that were facing some pretty difficult situations when it comes to rates. Your rates are obviously on the lower side, but I just wanted you to be aware of where other communities are. Okay, this was my attempt at humor, and this is as good as it gets. I don't want to scare anybody. What this was intended to do was just show you where wastewater's going and what you could face in the future. I know that you recently, I think, had a rate increase, or you're considering one, and Eamon and Jay have been doing some planning for putting money away for the future. I don't want to scare you that you're going to be out there doing St. Raymond South End at $25 million. I don't know where you will be. Part of that is because we don't know when these limits are going to come into effect. But part of our job is to bring the reality to the city that, no, it didn't come this permit, but it's coming. And you would rather be ahead of the game than behind the game and threaten development, you know, any kind of industry that may want to come to town and brings a lot of housing in. We just, in fact, that goes to my next slide. I pulled this shamelessly off of one of our SOQs. Our goal is to efficiently help Washington State communities preserve the environment, improve their quality of life, and management of growth. So that's my shameless, I don't want to scare you kind of tactic. We just wanted to make you aware of where the state's going. You know, you kind of, I don't want to put it that you got lucky, but you got a pretty forgiving permit this time around. And we can't guarantee that's going to happen every time, because you look around the state and there's plenty of communities that were facing very difficult permits at this time. So I don't know if I'm under my time limit, Eamon. But that's essentially what I was here to discuss with you. And just, you know, we do have a few things to work through with the city in the coming years. Ordinance, you have an issue with ecology with total suspended solids, but those are all very things that can be easily tackled, I would say, with just efforts between us and city staff. Are there any questions?
I do, of course.
Fire away, otherwise I'll think that you guys are interested.
you didn't scare me, but what scares us is Warden, 12 miles up the road, and it's a community a lot smaller than ours, had to spend $14 million for their mm-hmm. wastewater system. How come they just didn't put ponds in? That had to be cheaper than $14 million.
Where was the water going to go? They had a discharge. Their problem was they did have ponds. They had facultative lagoons just like yours. They have no body of water to discharge into up
Damn.
There. So what they were doing is they were putting them in unlined lagoons and then spraying it onto a spray field. Well, those unlined lagoons were leaking like a sieve. In fact, they were, I don't know it towards the end of the spray field life, if they were really ever running the spray field. So they were essentially putting untreated wastewater into the groundwater. It finally caught up with them with ecology. So their issue became, well, what do we do with the water once we treat it? We have no discharge. What they had to go to in their particular case, and it's similar to what Royal City, Ephrata, and Quincy does, is that they went to reclaimed water. So essentially, they treat wastewater to the highest level possible. Then they put it into the ground. And the idea there is they are reclaiming water and essentially putting it back into the aquifer. Yeah.
Basically through irrigation?
They put it in infiltration lagoons. But the difference before was they were infiltrating the groundwater. They weren't treating it. Now they treat it, then infiltrate it to groundwater. So groundwater, like we talk about going your permit that goes to a surface water, well, groundwater has a whole nother animal, groundwater quality standards that you have to meet. And so they went to reclaimed water so that they could put reclaimed water back into the ground that met groundwater quality standards. So yes, they spent between planning, design, and construction, they spent $10 million. I do have to caveat that a reclaimed water plant, which is the highest level of treatment, tends to be a bit more expensive than a conventional mechanical plant like what you may face. But you're right, it was an extreme undertaking by them. We actually started that design and then put it on hold because they didn't have funding. And they went to the legislature. Of course, this is well before a lot of this economic trouble with the state. They did a lot of lobbying, and they went to the state and got a direct legislative appropriation for their treatment plant. I don't exactly remember the amount, but we started that design. It got put on hold because the mayor was like, in their particular case, they weren't under a particular compliance. Well, they had compliance issues, but they weren't under a lawsuit, and they weren't under a sewer moratorium yet. So the mayor sort of felt like he could buy some time till they got their funding around. So their plant sat around for maybe a year after it was designed, before it was actually constructed, so that the mayor and council and our firm could continue to work and get them more and more funding. Now, they had a little bit of a reprieve there because they weren't under one of those lawsuits or compliance orders that said, you must build by this date. But their situation was a bit different because they don't have a surface water to go to. We would love to take that reclaimed water and put it in the Lynn Cooley. Or is it the Lynn Cooley? It's the big canal that goes. They have a canal, an irrigation canal, that goes right by their treatment plant.
They won't let them do
that?
They
won't let. The Bureau will not, in Washington State, will not let you put reclaimed water in a Bureau canal. They will in California. They love it. They love that water in Arizona and California. But in Washington State, thus far, reclaimed water has pretty much been shunned from the irrigation canals. It's kind of difficult because they're making water that we need, but they're putting it back in the ground rather than the Bureau canal. So that's a whole other debate that I could go on.
Are they filtering out particulate matter as they process it, where they actually get a sludge they have to haul off?
Yes, there's two products to wastewater. There's not only your liquid, but your solids. And those solids, what they do at this Warden is they dry those solids out on drying beds. That's one benefit in Eastern Washington. We got lots of sun. So they take that byproduct of solids, they dry them on drying beds, and then they haul them to a permitted site for bio. We call those biosolids. For biosolids, I think they may haul them up to Boulder Park, which is a big biosolids area. So yes, you're right. There's two products. We always talk about the liquid product that goes in our stream or in our groundwater, but the solid product that comes out also has regulations from the state that have to be dealt with.
What's in the bottom of our ponds? Is it
those solids, biosolids?
Yeah, but it was originally lined in '86 or so with diatomaceous earth or something. Does anybody know?
Yeah, you have some lined. You know, I have to admit, I'm not fully up on your your ponds are lined. Do you know what they're lined with for sure? All of them
diatomaceous earth.
Is that what it is? Yeah. And you know, if you read your permit, they don't have any. That is often ponds that have liners of any kind. That is often the complaint from ecology: this leaks or that leaks. In your permit, there's no indication that they are concerned with the integrity of your lagoons. They have been in the past, but currently they're pretty confident in the integrity of your lagoons. And you do some groundwater monitoring outside of those lagoons. You have some monitoring wells that they go out and sample every now and then to make sure that you're not contaminating outside of the lagoons. They do that, I think, on a quarterly basis.
If we're putting 2 million a day into our system, is 2 million a day going out into Owl Creek?
That's what your plant's rated for. So somebody back in the 70s decided that your plant could produce 2 million gallons per day on a max month basis. So around here, that's probably in the summer when you have a high influx of population. But the true flow of your plant is probably more around 1.2, 1.3 million gallons per day. And yes, it's an in-out deal. As much comes in, as much goes out.
We had previously discussed before what might be the cheap answer is to develop some kind of wetland area to where it comes, instead of going to the creek, goes to the wetland area and then overflows into the creek. Is that on the radar nowadays? Does that work?
There are a few places that do that, but I would caution that it's not as simple as it sounds. And wetlands are a lot of work. But there are places that do it. You know, King County put together a reclaimed water plant out in Carnation that goes to wetlands. It is definitely something, when we go through that planning process, I kind of went through that really fast because you guys obviously aren't quite there yet. But when we go through that planning process, one of the keys is to consider all alternatives. And that would include coming up with something other than discharging to Owl Creek. We have to consider everything. And that's part of our job, is to make sure that we consider as much as we can to give you a full scope. And wetlands may be something that we would consider at that time. But I just caution that from what we see, wetlands are not as easy as it may sound, although they are a viable alternative. I don't want to shun it, but I just don't want it to seem like it's an easy thing to do. If you talk to people that run wetlands, there's a lot of work involved with it, and there's definitely a lot of benefits to it, too, though. In fact, I went to a conference this last fall in Seattle, and there's a lot of people that take reclaimed water to wetlands, and there's a lot of great benefits to it.
Is there any cases where if these levels are too high of phosphorus or whatever, that people dilute on purpose? In other words, run potable water into their sewer system to lower those limits? Not feasible?
No. What you're doing, you're just, yeah. It's not something you want to do. It's not something you want to do. Oftentimes, if you have industries and you maybe have an imbalance of a particular nutrient, it's good to investigate those industries and make sure that there's somebody that's not discharging something illegal. But for the most part, we wouldn't promote dilution as a solution.
I have another question. We had heard rumors that even if our system is working properly, they could still make us switch. Is that true?
Yeah. If they come in with an ammonia limit and the state's looking at them everywhere, yes. Even if you're meeting your current permit, and by that I mean that BOD and total suspended solids and those metals, if they impose an ammonia limit, that would pretty much force you out of the lagoon game. And that just gets into the science of how lagoons work and how you do ammonia removal, and it's something that would force you into that mechanical treatment plant option, those types of things. What they will essentially do is they'll just ratchet down. It doesn't mean that you guys are doing a bad job or anything. They'll just essentially ratchet down your regulations that force you into doing it.
Any other questions?
Once again, I didn't want to scare you with all this, but we just wanted to be sure that you had a realistic view. And it's an important part of your infrastructure. We have seen cities that have a lot of issues, don't keep up their treatment plant, and then, you know, they face some pretty tough things with sewer moratoriums and things like that. And we certainly just don't ever want you guys to get there, so we want you guys to have a realistic view of where your wastewater is going in possibly the next 4 to 5 years.
I got one more. Have you seen anything as far as, the economy of the state and also the cities and whatnot of extending some of these permits and some of these requirements for a longer period of time? I know the economy of the state is bad and whatnot, and I've heard rumors that they're thinking about doing that on some of those permits, that they're going to put some extensions on them until some of this economy changes. Have you seen any indicators of that purpose?
I have not seen any of that. What I have seen is that ecology has put extensions on permits because they literally don't have the manpower to keep up with the permits and the cities. In fact, your permit, I think, was extended once for 6 to 9 months because they didn't have the manpower. But as far as economy, there's money. It's the money, the influx of money to the state. The state got $90 million of ARRA money last year to do wastewater projects. Yet, we all know that we lost Public Works Trust Fund, which would have been $400 million over a biennium. So it's difficult. The state really doesn't say, we're sorry, you're a poor city. They just want you to look for the money, and they want you to look everywhere, RD, bonds, everything. There was some ARA money this year. Of course, that's not going to be there every year anymore. But it's been a difficult year because while we got some money, they took money away. And I have not seen the state give any reprieve because of the economy. It's more of a reprieve because they don't have the manpower to manage the permits.
The reason I say that, like our public trust or public works trust fund and whatnot, is no longer any money available in that particular fund. And I don't think there will be for a period of time until they rebuild that fund. And I've heard rumors that there might be a possibility that they might be extending some of that until some of this money gets back again. Don't mark my word. But.
Well, I've definitely seen some communities that weren't under compliance orders that had to do upgrades because of growth. And so they were relying on Public Works Trust Fund, which is one of those great programs that reward you for good maintenance and keeping up with growth and keeping up with your systems. That's why I love Public Works Trust Fund. So I have seen a few communities that put off their and they're just waiting for that cheaper money to come back. But it may get to the point where we have to extend permits, because if you can't do it, you can't do it. You know, no money, no money.
Well, thank you, Nancy, for coming. Appreciate the education.
And Eamon, I would appreciate if we could put together what the median income is for Othello and see where that 2% is and how we compare to that.
Okay, consideration of Main Street improvements. Jay?
Last, let me. Last council meeting, we reviewed with staff and city engineers the cost and details of improving Main Street from 7th to 14th Avenue. Possible funding options for this project were presented to council in two different options. And included in this packet that we give you tonight were the funding options from Gray and Osborne, or their presentation, the funding options. And tonight, Larry is here to answer any additional questions you might have about this project and see if we have any additional questions that we didn't go over last week.
Any questions from council?
I have a few. Okay, right now we're looking at 7th to 14th Street, approximately 2.7 million, pretty close.
That's 2.6.
2.6, okay. How about the rest of it, 7th to 1st Street, okay. Or Main Street?
I discussed that with Eamon and Jay today, and if I may, apologies for the last second handout here. Have a little bit of information regards what it would cost to do all three phases at one time. And we did not have an overhead of this, but just a real quick presentation. Lesson. If we were to look at all three phases, again, we think we would see at least a 10% savings over the original presentation, the 1st of January, just because of the economy of scale. The fact that we're doing everything at once leads itself to better unit prices, less mobilization, less contingency, less engineering costs, less inspection costs. So we'd be looking at, we think, not quite $6.5 million for all three phases, street work, water, storm, and signals. And that compares to the about 2.6 for just phase one.
If we wanted to do things in phases and save 10 to 20%, what if we didn't do the signals as part of the project?
Signals would drop out probably about $400,000. Well, actually, pardon me, that's $400,000 just in phase one. We look at all the phases.
Regulations making us redo the signals, or is it because we're redoing the road, or is that just included as part of the project?
It's a little bit of both. In a couple cases, the arms that reach out over the road aren't the proper length. I think in one case, the at 11th, We wanted to completely redo it. It does not have to be done now. If we were to put sleeves in the road so that in the future wires could be just put in to cross the street without having to cut the street open, we'd see a pretty substantial savings there.
There were, besides the two in phase one, there were two additional, right? Four total.
So we could probably see about a $700,000 to $800,000 savings over the 6.5 figure. So it'd be roughly 5.7, 5.8 around there.
So I guess my question would be for Mike on the water end of it. Do we have that kind of money?
Yes, I believe we do. Now, of course, Larry's numbers are a little lower than the ones I used in the handout I gave you tonight, because I was using the ones from January, like you talked about. Doing the whole project and saving 10% was a little bit different, because I was working with a number that totaled 7.1 million, and he mentioned 6.5, and then if you take the signals out, we're down to 5.8. And the funding just really starts to look a lot different. But the scenario I set up is for the water. There is quite a bit of reserves in water, and then we can cover the rest of it within like an interfund loan from the sewer department. And water, our rates are designed to build up reserves, so it wouldn't be. I don't believe it would be a hardship on water to pay the interfund loan back in, say, a 3 to 5 year period. So I think water would be taken care of. For the balance of the street portion, I believe we have to bond. We couldn't if we do the whole project. We couldn't fund it internally.
Have to bond.
Jack McLaughlin did send me these schedules for 20-year scenario, 25-year, and 30-year for a council money bond issue, and these are hot off the press today. So everything in here is based on information he got from the market today in terms of what the cost would be for that bond issue. Once again, these numbers are high because I'm using the older numbers.
What is his interest for a 25-year bond?
25. It goes from 4% in the early part to 5.5 down towards the last end of the last part of that.
Any more questions for Mike? I guess I have another question for Larry. I know you told us the other week, but I can't remember it. What is the life expectancy of our road doing it this way?
On a chip seal, or excuse me, an oak grind and overlay, they can typically last 12 to 15 years, sometimes even longer, depending upon how you care for the road. If you do crack sealing, fog seals, which is basically an asphalt emulsion that would paint the road, if you keep up on it like that, you could see 20 years. It also depends upon the volume of traffic and the type of traffic. Main Street will see a lot of passenger vehicles, but it will also see some heavier trucks. I know we talked at the last meeting about what do we want to do as far as truck routes. The more trucks you keep off of it, the longer the life expectancy.
I got one quick one here. If we did do this whole project and we're figuring, say, 4 to 5% on the interest of this money to do it, if you'd look at that another way and wait for a year, 2 years down the road, you're gonna lose more than that in inflation costs of construction than what the amount would actually cost you.
Good point.
To go out and do this. So I'm wondering if maybe that's not a bad way to go.
From everything I've been hearing, construction costs are at pretty much a low right now.
Very competitive. A lot of hungry contractors.
Well, me and Ken were at the legislative conference last week. And if we sit around waiting for money, it's going to be a long time. Because I don't think there's going to be any state money out there to help. There was talk, and the AWC was trying to push the street utility. But I don't think that's going to happen after talking to a few of the legislators. That's imposing a new tax upon the people. And like I said, I don't think that's going to happen right now. We do have the means to finance this ourselves and do it with our existing funds and councilmatic bonds. I'm not interested in going out to the public and asking for more money. I really believe we need to do it with what they give us right now. And if we could save quite a bit by doing the whole project right now, I think it is a good investment in the future. But I'm very interested in some of the numbers for the councilmatic bonds right now. Councilmatic bonds.
We have that presentation tonight.
I can show you a graphic.
Quick here.
This is a graphic of the 25-year scenario. I don't, do we have to fill out that? Here we go. What I did is, here's our existing debt service. And so what I did is I took an average of that. What? Let's see. Oh, I know. Yeah, I took an average of this, and it came out to be $182,000, roughly. So I deducted the $182,000 from this annual amount here. So the incremental increase over our current debt service is about $178,000. It averages a little different than that. But this would be the incremental increase on an annual basis. We're currently paying this out of the utility tax fund, so it's not impacting the general fund. And once again, this number is high. If on the numbers that Larry gave tonight, just based on putting the whole project together to save 10%, and then. I think we're all aware of the fact that the bids are coming in lower because the competition for the work is better than it's ever been. And I was talking to Jack McLaughlin today, and he said he started naming some things that are happening. And I think we've heard about a fire station that was built recently, and I think the bid came in about $800,000 under the engineering estimates and so on. So. Not only is it going to be lower because of the issues that Larry brought up, but once again, I think we're in an environment right now where it's to our advantage to put it out to bid.
So is that showing me the total payment is 300? For example, year 2015 or 16 will be $360,000 just for the Main Street project.
That's correct. And this is for the entire project.
Now, I mean, we're financing $2.6 million of the first project internally. I mean, we can still cut that in half, can't we, if we finance half internally?
On the first project, the entire project was about $2.6 million. Six of that was water, and water was basically paying their own way. So we were funding, internally, we were funding about $1.988 or $2 million internally. On this scenario here, and I'll bring up a graphic here. On this scenario here, the highlighted portions are just the totals for each phase. On the part that I handed out to you, they all say phase one. I got a little carried away here, and so they all say 7 to 14. These numbers are correct, although they are the earlier numbers done in January. So these are higher numbers. Well, so then down here for funding, I'm showing the water taking care of its portion. Here, I should use this right here. I'm showing the water taking care of its portion here. Once again, an interfund loan, say from the sewer, would take care of this balance here. So water would be taken care of. So we could. I was using some internal funds here to get the amount down around 4.3. So the Council-O-Matic debt service schedules that Jack gave me were based on the number of 4.3. This number now looks like it could go even lower based on the information we have from tonight.
Well, the point is, we not only have the Council-O-Matic bond, we're depleting other reserves.
Yeah, yes, on this scenario.
And does that include borrowing from the sewer too?
No, there is nothing from the sewer. The only thing here is I would recommend taking care of this balance from the water fund, but with an interfund loan from the sewer. So that would be a short term, 3 to 5 year loan. So when we're faced with this permitting thing for our sewer again, that money would be back in the reserves of the sewer fund. And once again, these are just suggestions. The general fund, I only recommended $200,000. This would leave a little over $1 million in reserves in the general fund. The street fund, I originally had about $210,000 in here, and I bumped that down to $100,000. We're going to be faced with a new Vactor truck in the next year or two, and that's going to be a $300,000 purchase. And so I felt like we needed to leave some reserves in the street fund. So I just recommended $100,000 here. Once again, these are recommendations. This is using all the REIT funds. The REIT fund has been around for a long time, and we just really haven't used those funds. So here's utility taxes. Once again, I think we have a little over $800,000 in the utility tax fund scheduled for the end of 2010. So there would still be $280,000 or almost $300,000 remaining in reserves in the utility tax fund at the end of the year. And of course, that fund is replenished every year.
I've got another question, Tim. Go ahead. What effect would this do if we, say, completed Main Street? What effect would this do to our South Broadway project? What would it do to that?
It really shouldn't do anything, Ken. We're targeting whatever grants and loans we can find for that project, and in hopes that we wouldn't have to have any out-of-pocket funds from the city, so that one loan could be the leverage or the match against another grant.
Good.
It might make us more competitive because we could show that we've used Council-O-Matic limits for another project and these other reserve funds in another project. So it might make us more competitive for some grants and loans.
So you're talking about the industrial?
Right. Yeah, okay. I didn't know whether we was going to try to use some of our money as match money to get some of those funds, but I think that they would look at it. What you're saying is that if we're doing one project, we're using basically our money, that they would consider that as match money for the overall project. So, okay,
so here, let's make sure I understood. I had the same question I had it written down right here. So if we don't have any money because we tie it up, we still can get money to do that area.
Yeah, we'll actually score more points on some of the applications for funding by saying that we've used all of the reserves we had for another critical project, and we don't have the funds to put in towards a low-interest loan or going to a bank for a loan or for matching funds. And that's particularly key when we look at economic development funding.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering, because the president keeps talking about that, but I don't know how much money he's going to kick out for it. That's why I just... That's what my concern, a big project like this, was tying all the money up, and then all of a sudden this money is available for, you know, building businesses, and we can't do it, or at least the area for it. So Mike, how long are we going to be? I guess one way to put it in my layman's way is how long we're going to be tight? Take 2 or 3 years to come out, or before we start seeing some funds again that we have to really available to use?
Well, if, you know, well, the thing about the Councilmatic, of course, is we're not using as much internal funds if we go to a Councilmatic issue. I really feel like the utility tax fund has the capacity for this amount of debt service. And it's still leaving funding for overlay projects and the ongoing things that we do annually. I believe we can meet those needs out of the utility tax fund.
So we'll be okay still for, we've talked repeatedly on the council about a new park. We should be okay on that, or?
That's good. Yeah, I haven't addressed that. I tell you, we do have some money set aside for the purchase of a park. And in terms of development, I wouldn't even have a clue what that would look like financially.
Well, I think one perspective we have to look at is if we tie it into this and want to develop a new park, community centers, etc., that utility fund is going to have to be made available to the point where 50% of it now goes to the general fund. Mm-hmm. We might have to cut that back to 40%, and that's going to create some hardships. People are going to be sharpening their pencils to get by, because we are in good shape because of that utility fund. I mean, I don't know if people realize that, but that's kind of carrying us, and why the utility fund is so big here is because of the two industries in town, and it all filters down that for us to even be able to discuss this and for our running our general budget without raising taxes excessively. So that's the part of it that I think there might have to be some kind of concession, that not 50% of it doesn't get to go to the general fund. And there's been a lot of discussion of what that fund was, the utility fund was originally set up for, and that's, you know, whatever. It's up to us now to decide how it best benefits not only the citizens, but the industry that pays into that fund, majority of it. Off the top of your head, what did the utility fund generate last year?
About 1.5 million.
Yeah. And half of that went to just a general operational budget.
That's correct. In every city I've ever been to, the utility tax went directly into the general fund for operations. So this is very, very rare. We are very, very fortunate here that we still have that utility tax fund as an option. Most cities are using that for operations.
Would you say if it wasn't for the plants, that fund would be cut in half?
Well, the brokered natural gas is a really big thing, and I don't know who uses that, and I'm assuming it's the plants, because I can't imagine anything else that would require that much. It's got to be the plants. So that would impact it. I mean, the brokered natural gas isn't the only thing. Of course, we're still
right.
Using well with.
Yeah, they're using a lot of power too,
right.
Electricity.
Right. We have regular natural gas, and we have, of course, electricity, and we have telephone. But I think the brokered natural gas has got to be close to 40% of that fund.
That's my biggest concern. I don't want to stretch this out too far that we start neglecting some of our other projects that we've
right.
Got to look at this year to do.
Sounds like we're going to be all right. I guess, Mike, we'd like to hear from you next week to really examine this, doing this method, what it would do to us, really take a hard look at it.
Okay.
You know what I mean? And give us a feel for how we'd be sitting, I guess. I still have questions in my own mind,
sure.
But I like the thought 10% savings is a lot of money.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it'd be nice to do the whole thing at once.
Yes.
But at the same time,
but if you go back to that, the first few years till we pay off the current loan on this building, we're doing almost $500,000 would go to the existing the DS, which is what the DS.
Oh, debt service?
Debt service, existing debt service, plus what we would inherit with the Main Street for the first 5 or 6 years,
right.
$500,000 or
right.
A third of that utility fund going to go to those two items.
Yeah, we pay interest only for the first, looks like the first 5 years we're paying interest only on the council matting, and combined with our existing debt service. So it keeps the annual debt service pretty even.
Well, that's that. There's nowhere you've totaled the existing with the new for the first 6 years, though. It's close to $500,000 or more.
These numbers are high.
Well,
If you want to, I could bring this back Monday. I could get some new numbers from Jack McLaughlin, and I'm sure they're going to look a little different. And I'll work with Larry in terms of. He gave us the number on the 10%, if you want to leave the signals out, if you want me to do the scenario without the signals, I can do that. I could do it both ways.
Look at a couple scenarios.
Sure.
We have to talk about Olympia Street tonight. We need to put that in or take it out. We'll just do an add and delete for you and show you the different numbers and tell us which one you want to do.
Yeah. In the scenario that I presented tonight, I did not use Olympia Street. So that would still be in the budget to be done in 2010 as a street project. So that's certainly an option if you wanted to take that out. I think the thing I'd like to work with Larry about is to try to come up with a scenario. I mean, it's kind of hard, I think, especially if I was an engineer, to come up with an engineering estimate and say, bids are coming in low, so maybe we should, you know what I mean? That'd be kind of scary, because then he's kind of on the hook. So I wouldn't know quite how to face that, you know? But it is a reality. It's just like, what would it look like? But we'll come up with
We'll do the scenario as you put the numbers.
Okay.
If we went out to councilmatic bonds on a portion of this, do we have to do that portion first before we go out to bid to have our money in place? Or could we go out to bid first?
Say that again.
If we go councilmatic bonds, do we have to collect our councilmatic bonds first or have our financing put in place first before we go out to bid? Or can we go out to bid and find out what our total is and go out for a total loan that we need left?
People that bid want to make sure that you have your financing in place before you bid. That doesn't mean you can't mix and match or switch around. Like we talked about, if we apply for a couple of grants, that they wouldn't supplant some of the city money. Uh, we
one more question here. When we put that out to bid, could we do this to the contractor? Could we put out option one, option two? In other words, option one, we do the whole project. Option two, we just do from 7th to 14th. That'll take care of both items. It'll give us an idea of what those contractors, the feeling of where they're at and what they're doing, and then we would know exactly what we got. We could go ahead and set up our funding for whatever we want to have done, but we could have that option that we could look at it again when those bids come in.
Another little item you could do, typically we put into the construction contracts that contractors have to honor their bids for 60 days after bid opening to give time for the city to review and award. We could make that 90 days or 120 days, probably stretching it 120, but we could still put it in there. So that would give us time. I'm not sure how long it would take to go through the councilmatic bonds.
I'll find that out.
But that might buy us a little more time also.
Right. I talked to Cynthia Wiener, our bond attorney today, and it's about 90 days, and that's fast track.
Because I definitely don't want to bond more than what we absolutely have to. And
yeah, but isn't pretty common language to say we can reject any and all bids?
Yes.
So we could get the bids, and if we don't like the numbers, just say the project's off.
There has been precedent set in other, it happened in a school district up in the basin where they wanted to just see what it would cost to put a portable in. They really weren't planning on doing the project, so they went out for bids to see what the costs were rather than paying an architect to do that. And the contractor found out about it after they rejected the bids, sued the school district and won for the time it took them to put his bid together. So the state's very cautious when it comes to how and what you do with the bidding processes. But Ken's idea of putting optional with owner schedules or alternates in is very commonplace.
But there's a bid line relative to percentages of the total project for options too. We have to be careful with that.
Right.
Great. Anything else, anybody? Well, thank you again, Larry, for coming, and Nancy. Okay, Adams County Fire District, number 5, yearly report. Chief Baca.
Not quite there yet. Good evening. Well, our year-end report resulted in ...126 calls total for last year, which is up a little over 30% a year prior. And as you see, false alarms are leading calls, which jumped up quite a bit this year. We saw an increase in fires, though, as well, but no substantial fire loss other than the pet rescue fire and the Hemlock House fire. It was a vacant house at the time as well. So no significant fire loss this year. And our inspection program is ongoing. We see over 200 every year on an annual basis. Part of those are schools, high occupancy facilities, churches, etc. And we're teaming with the Washington State Fire Marshal's office with the schools right now as far as that construction. So, but if you have questions, I'd be more than happy to answer.
The false alarms, are they mainly the plants out here?
It's spread out through the community.
Oh, really?
One of the plants is one of the high numbers, but the false alarms, we get residential false alarms too, as well as small commercial and then the industry as well. And if you notice on the report I added to this report. Probably your first time seeing it is our average response time for our first unit in after a tone is 4 minutes and 24 seconds. So
that's fast.
That's within a few seconds of the past 5 years, one way or another.
Is that consideration on our fire rating?
Yes, it is. It is.
But you know, with the volunteer fire department, that is really good. Really good response time.
Is the first arriving, can that be a command unit?
It can be. And this time of year, it'd be a dry unit.
Right, oh, that's right.
Summertime, it'd be a wet unit. And that's all the way from a service call, which come check my sprinkler system, to a full-blown fire. Anytime we're toned out, we record our response times.
So, firemen, how many do we have?
I looked today, and there was 41 on the roster.
Is that the number you like? Or how many do you like?
That's a pretty consistent average for the last 4 or 5 years, right in the 40. We had a high of 45, and I think our low was about 38 here in the past few years. We've got applications today I went through. We had 14 new applications for our recruit class, so should be a good class. It's going to start the second week of this month and run through the end of April.
Any other questions from council? I want to say thank you for inviting the council and the mayor to your dinner and other people that came. I know the chief went. Enjoyed it very much.
Well, thank you. Have a good evening.
Thank you for coming.
Okay, police chief report. Chief Denneke?
Well, you don't use the mouse, do you? Yeah, that's okay. That mouse about goes too fast. I will be really quick. I know it's getting a little late. Good evening, Mr. Mayor and members of council. Instead of doing a monthly report at the end that was written and included in your packets, I decided to do kind of a verbal visual presentation on what the police department actually accomplished in 2009 and where we're going, what our goals are for 2010. So we'll just go right through it, and unless there's something really confusing or you have a question, I'll kind of blaze right on through, okay? Personnel issues in 2009, we were able to complete our hiring process, and now we're at 100% staff levels. Our last officer was Officer Josh Silva, who is a local kid. During 2009, we were able to exceed the state minimum for individual officer training requirements. There is a state mandatory by RCW that each officer receives so much training. For the second year running, we were able to meet that, and actually we exceeded that. We added an extra field training officer in Blake Hampton. We sent him to the field training program so he could help out with our training needs. Also, for personnel in 2010, for 2010, we're going to continue working with to ensure completion of probation. Officer Treasure, Officer Plummer, Officer Gilbert, and Officer Silva, who are all still on probation. Nobody's left on field training, but they still have their probationary period to go. Programs in 2009, we were able to continue with our Explorer program, which is a high school students sponsored by police department. We actually increased our membership in 2009. We were able to run a whole full year on our CCID, which is criminal case intake and disposition forms, where we actually get feedback from the prosecutor so each individual officer knows exactly what kind of results are for their cases. So if they submit a case, we get a dispo back. It was either accepted, declined, went to trial, the guy pled out, we get some kind of idea on the sentence, and then also we get notification that we can release evidence, which is a very big part of that and key for me. We were able to continue with our Lexapol policy manual, which is great. It's working very well. Our Lexapol training bulletins are still in place. That's working good. We converted over to Sector this year through helps with folks from WASPIC, and now the officers are able to do their traffic collision reports and citations electronically. Goes right to the state. Now the state files and maintains the records for collisions. So when we need a copy for an insurance company or whatever, we just go online, print a copy, and it's a done deal. So that particular system can go paperless. And we had our RUAD, underage drinking, as you are all aware. Equipment in 2009, we did buy our two new cars. We put new laptop computers in all the cars. Those were purchased late in 2009, and that was based on we're being reimbursed from a federal grant that we got. We're working in our evidence room. We were able to get our safes that we needed in place, and so those are all there. We are also able to get two new dispatch computers and then three squadron computers. Step behind. Now I'm going too fast. My brain, my hand, and my computer button here. Okay, budget in 2009 and 2010. In 2009, the police department actually returned about $100,000 that we did not use. And for 2010, we recreated our 2009 budget with a 5% increase, which was mandated by contract, in wage and benefits for all the employees. Then what we did was we sharpened our pencil, to coin a phrase by Councilman Spohr, and we cut back in areas where I felt that we could actually help out and cut back in. So our 2010 budget was actually less than a 5% increased budget, like what would have happened if we would have just kept everything the same. With our 2010 budget, we're able to maintain critical line items. We have no layoffs that we have to worry about. There is one officer position that is froze. We will be able to still buy our two new cars. We still have some emphasis on small equipment. But overall, we took a very conservative approach for 2010 because we don't know what the effects of the state and the national budget shortfalls in the economy are going to be. So we're trying to ready ourselves in case it gets a little tighter. In 2010, the programs that we continue to have or participate in, we were once again able to get a block grant, and that actually pays for part of my salary to participate in the DV Consortium for Grant and Adams County. I do a lot of other domestic violence related work around both our counties, and I attend violence seminars with regard to that. We want to continue with our Lexapol policy and our daily training bulletins. We want to integrate into the NIBR system, which will be mandated for all reporting agencies in 2012. We're actually ahead of the curve here. We have paid through our budget for the last 2 years the $12,000 that was needed from Othello for Adams County to upgrade into NIBRS. So we're all ready to go. We're actually in the process of training now. They're doing some Spillman updates, and pretty soon we'll be able to start submitting dual reports, both NIBRS and UCR, which is the Uniform Crime Reporting System, so that when it does go mandate or when we do go live, we'll have already been there. We'll already have work through whatever bugs that might be to do that. The National Incident-Based Reporting System, which is the new standard, will give us more of a look as to what really is happening within our community, because currently UCR, there's like 8 categories that they keep track of. But with NIBRS, there would be like 31 categories that the national, that the feds will take care of. This year, I'm participating in a statewide committee to investigate initiatives and solutions to gang problems. I continue to work with the DV Consortium. We continue as a department to work with CBIT, which is a Columbia Basin investigative team, serious felony multi-agency investigations. This started out to be a group of investigators that could respond to an officer-involved shooting, because from time to time they happen in Grant and Adams counties. So the agency has pulled together, realizing the seriousness and the complication of those investigations, we agreed to work together in that. Well, it's since then has broadened out a little bit, so when Afreda has a homicide or we have a homicide, and it's a complicated issue or a complicated case, we can bring in investigators from those other agencies who will do the first 24, 48-hour rush to get the information that we need to be able to investigate that and put that case to some kind of good closure. Adams County Community Network, we're still participating in that. The paid and community mobilization, Law and Justice Commission, myself and Councilman Snyder attend that. I still attend the Law Enforcement Roundtable, which is the department heads from all of the agencies in Grant and Adams County. We're looking forward to instituting our TIPS 411 text line, and that is that's on its way. It will be here very soon. And what that is, it'll be a means for people to text us 411 tips on crime or information that they want the police to have, and they can maintain their anonymity, and we will never be able to know their identity. We're really looking forward to that. As you know, we have a large population of technologically young people who do more texting than they do anything else, and so we're hoping that that is going to be successful. We're engaging in it for a one-year trial period, and then we'll see if it works for us or not. We are also participating in the Emergency Medical Services Trauma Council. Who went with me on that?
I did.
Councilman Johnson went with me on that. So the next program we're going to join with is GangNet, which is a computer database of known gang members and activities. All the contributing agencies are East Side. So Yakima contributes, Spokane contributes. I think Grant County is signing up to do it. There is a cost involved, but it will be a normal budget thing. It won't be something I have to come back and ask for special money for. Accomplishments: in 2009, we established a live scan program, which is we actually instituted online fingerprints. It's eliminated all of our mistakes and our do-overs, so we don't have any more of those. And it also gives us fairly instantaneous feedback. So if we fingerprint somebody and they've got a warrant or something or wanted for questioning of a serious crime, that will get back to us in about 24 hours versus a couple of months like it used to. We filled the last academy, we talked about that, 2 cars, marched and seated. Last year we were able to reduce our overtime obligation by 43% or 735 hours. We completed 1 true community-based problem-solving project. Updated the change on the graphics on our patrol cars. Some of them you'll see have new graphics. We still have a couple of cars left to do, but we're waiting for the new budget cycle. And so any car that we're having to keep for 2 or more years, we're going to go ahead and put the new graphics on. We're in the process of establishing less than lethal training, beanbag, or it's actually called kinetic projectiles. The department, when I came here, had a whole bunch of old shotguns, old 12-gauge shotguns. So what we've done is we've bought new forearms and stocks, colored. I think they're bright orange or something. those have been dedicated or will be dedicated to less than lethal projectiles. So if we ever get into a situation where we could shoot somebody with a firearm, if we have that shotgun technology with a beanbag, we'll be able to use that instead, which is less than actual shooting them. And we successfully cleaned up our $250,000 RUAD grant. Accomplishments continued. 2009, we established an investigator's position. This is also part of the master plan to create stability with our employees so that we aren't continuing to train officers for other agencies. This is a training position. It's a 3-year commitment. The idea is to bring them in, give them the premier training in different categories, and then put them back out on the road where they can take that expertise back into patrol and then put somebody else in and give them that chance. It creates another career path. Training includes an interview and interrogation all the way up through advanced homicide investigation, basic and advanced crime scene investigation, sexual assault, child sexual assault, and abuse investigations. In 2010, we hope to finish our upgrade of the evidence intake, including a HEPA drying cabinet. As you know, a lot of evidence these days is based on DNA. We have a lot of evidence, blood evidence, body fluid evidence that needs to be brought in here and dried properly to maintain the integrity of the DNA value of that piece of evidence. We don't have a proper drying facility. We put it in a closet and then put a fan in there. And so we're upgrading that, making sure that the cabinet filters out any bad thing that may get into the air so that we cut down on airborne toxins, if there are any, and we maintain the integrity of that evidence. We want to do a Citizen Academy. We've had one. We didn't have one last year. We're going to have our spring fling in service. Last year it was March. This year it's going to be in April, so we're calling it spring fling. We got to do our vehicle still. We want to finish our accreditation process. We were actually signed up for accreditation in the first or the second week of December, but the coordinator at WASPIC forgot to write it on his calendar, so the day came and went, and they didn't show up. So we're ready to go with that now. We have the union negotiations that we need to do this year, so hopefully we'll get that successfully completed by December. We have an annual evidence audit where we will actually go through the whole entire evidence room and make sure every piece of evidence is there. We're going to upgrade, we're looking at upgrading our pistols with Crimson Trace laser sights, do problem-oriented police training for the newest officers that we have on the department. Tomorrow we're going to establish a Spanish community outreach through weekly interviews on the local radio station. Our Spanish-speaking officers will actually be going over to the local radio station, which is a satellite office. One of their reporters or whoever is going to do it will be coming here and will be providing information to the Spanish-speaking only community about law enforcement and about Othello. So we're really excited about that. Our crime goals for this year is to reduce our car thefts by 50% and reduce the thefts from autos by 50%, since that seems to be a fairly significant problem for us. We have some training left. The investigator's gone to some. He still has all of those that you see there. He did attend the background investigation, so that's all taken care of. He's already completed those. Investigation accomplishments since about September of last year when he started. Felony cases solved were 11. Felony arrests made 15. Number of robbery charges out of those 10. Number of felony theft charges 2. And aggravated assault, which means serious assaults, 11 charges. So we're really proud that, of the job that he's doing in there. It's been beneficial to everybody. 2009, there were 8 complaints about against our personnel. 2 of the complaints came internally and 6 came from external sources. Out of those 8 complaints, 2 were exonerated, 4 were unfounded, and 2 were sustained. The 2 sustained complaints resulted in both letters of reprimand. Reported use of force in 2009, our total use of force applications were 8. Now this means the use of force above and beyond normal handcuffing. Handcuffing is a use of force as well, but it's something that's routine and regular. This is above that. We had a total of 1% last year. All the use of force applications were reviewed and found to be reasonable, and the pursuit review concluded that the participating officer acted within policy. Our monthly traffic enforcement for 2009, I like to see about a 3-to-1 ratio where we're issuing 3 warnings to 1 citation, and you'll see that we pretty well managed to maintain that all the way across the calendar. And so the top number is the number of actual citations for that month, and then the red is verbal warnings, and then contacts in general. And contacts means people that we come in contact for some reason other than a traffic citation, and then they are not contacts that we used as like a complainant or a victim in a report because they're counted separately. So these are the officers out driving around in the middle of the night to contact somebody for a reason, or the day for a reason. Felony misdemeanor arrests for 2009, it gives you kind of a breakdown in the numbers. You'll see that last year our big months were January, August, and October. 2009-2008 year to change, we had a reduction in felony arrests, 10.5%, and a 12.4% reduction in misdemeanor arrests. You'll see the numbers across the bottom. 2008, we had 219 felonies and 371 misdemeanors. 2009 saw 196 and 325. So there was a reduction. Part 1 crimes, these are the UCR crimes that we report to WASPIC and they report to the federal government. We had no homicides. We were down 50% in our forcible rape. Our robberies went up. Assaults went down significantly. And so our burglaries went down a very small amount, but you'll see that they're really down from 2007. So we're keeping a lid on that. And then our thefts went down quite a bit, and our motor vehicle thefts went down only by a few. But you can see 41 motor vehicle thefts in 2009. That's a significant number for a community this size. So we're going to really work hard to getting that down. Calls for service. Over 2008 to 2009, we had an increase of, 850. So in 2009, we received 850 more calls for service than we did in 2008. Any questions? Yes.
The one of the challenges in our community is we're a long way from a jail, and
yes,
so
it is.
There's a balance between cite and release versus an officer spending 3 hours away from the community to transport somebody to Ritzville. What's your philosophy on that balance?
We do well. A lot of it is determined by the jail these days, because actually when we want to book somebody in jail, we'll actually call to see what their status is and they won't take it. So sometimes we can't put somebody in jail because the jail will not take them because they're full. So we have to do other things. For small crimes, the officers can go ahead and cite and release. There's a lot of contributing factors. How busy are we that day? Really, what is the crime? Is it a shoplifting crime where an 18-year-old stole a $10 thing? That doesn't, does that warrant a trip to the jail, that kind of thing. So, and each officer is given the discretion to make up his own mind based on the circumstances, because they know better what they need to do right at that time. So they have the discretionary power to cite and release. one of the things that we, there are other things that we can do. We are a 6-hour temporary holding facility. So if we have a DUI at night and we have people on, if they don't want to cite and release that guy and the jail won't take him, and we can't find a, you know, an angry spouse to come pick him up, then we can hold them for 6 hours in the jail and let them sleep it off for at least 6 hours, then cut them loose, give them their citation, and let them go. So there are a few other ways that we can skin the cat, so to speak. Good question.
Part of the RUAC grant was compliance checks. Since that's expired, have you been able to still maintain some of those compliance checks? Or?
We have not done any since it expired, but that's something that we plan to continue to do. We'll probably end up doing it once a quarter in 2010. And we'll just do that with people that we have work. And we have, there's been enough people that have worked the program, they understand it, they know what to do. We have the contacts, so we can just do that on a Friday night, regular shift. I'll stay over and help if I need to, so it's fun to do. But we can just work that right into the program.
You had mentioned community-based problem-solving. You'd done one this year or something? What is that?
Yes, we did a fairly large project. We had a problem alley with graffiti. So we actually assigned three officers actually to that project. They actually went door to door, multiple times to invite the residents to a meeting. They contacted all of the absent landlords by way of mail to invite them to a meeting to discuss this issue of graffiti that was going on in this alley. And it was repeated. We would catch it and paint it over, and it would be back the next day or the day after. So then the officers worked with Public Works, who did a good job. We worked with the Explorer Post, and we went in and totally cleaned up the alley. We took up all of the garbage. We hauled off people's branches. We coordinated with the city vegetation abatement day and cleaned the alley. Public Works improved the approaches, and we did have some interest, you know. It wasn't as much as you would like, of course, but we did have residents that showed up. We had property owners that showed up that made commitments, you know, to call us and watch what was going on in their neighborhoods. Property owners made the commitment that, hey, if there is a graffiti problem or whatever, I'm going to take care of it right away. I'm not going to let it go. And it has reduced our problem. We haven't got any more graffiti in that particular alley. So it was, it probably took a month and a half to do it. All the police department, Public Works, property owners, renters, the city crew that took care of the brush. It was a great project, and it was taught a lot of lessons to a lot of people. So we're really moving there. I believe in that. We have a goal. I want two done this year, similar type projects where we actually, I would like the officers to pick up. This is a project I'd like to do and then let them run with it so that they learn how to do that.
I would like to say, I think it's a compliment to you and your staff, is one of the things I notice personally is the visibility of the officers out there. And I think it's partly the philosophy used and instilled. It's partly they've got the computers in their cars, so they're not in here doing reports as much. Very seldom do I drive around town and don't see an officer, at least one on patrol or one even just sitting there. It's good to see. And they have places where they get off the side of the road a little bit. I won't divulge those, so they a little sneaky. But there is a presence out there, and we have a full force, and that helps too. But I think it's a real compliment to our department that they're out there, they're on the roads, and if you listen on the scanner, they're pulling people over and doing a good job for our community.
Well, I'm happy to hear that. Yeah, I'm very proud of our staff. There are a lot of great young people there. There's a lot of talent and skills to be developed. They're eager. They're eager to learn, and they're eager to go out and do their work. So, yeah, they're doing a good job. And I've heard that comment repeatedly from citizens as well, so it is something that they're noticing.
And I don't know if people realize how lucky we are, but in some big cities, if you get egged or shoplifted a business, or there's an accident on a private lot, a minor accident, the police don't even show up. They'll just say, write a report. And we're lucky in this that we have big-time professionalism, but we're still small enough where the officers, they continue to show up at these incidents. And it would be a real paradigm shift for our community to call up and say, I got egged, and for an officer not to show up, say, okay, we'll report it. Because right now they are showing up, and you get that feeling that you're being helped, and the police are actually being aware of stuff.
Okay, thank you. You see them around a lot. The other thing I think is, with each one of them having their own car, all you have to do is drive around town. You keep seeing these police cars and sheriff's cars all over town. You know, so there's, it's just the idea that when you drive by somebody's house, oh, there's a cop lives right next door. And the other thing, I guess, I put in an alarm system, and we had company, and they set off the alarm. And within about 3 minutes of the time that alarm went off, maybe even less, if somebody pulled up at the door, and I was outside, he said, who are you? And I said, I live here. Somebody set the alarm off. He said, let me see your ID. I want to know for sure you live here. Fine, thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Beaver. I'm gone, and everything's okay. You don't need any help. No, I'm fine. But it didn't take very long for him to get there, And I remember when, years ago, Broadway Lumber had an alarm system down here, and somebody broke into that place, stole all the guns and ammunition out of it. And that alarm system came up here to the police department. By the time they got down there, the guys were gone, over the fence and out. But,
it can happen very quickly.
In that kind of a time, you'd be hard-pressed to collect 20 guns that are chained to a wall and all the ammunition and get them over the fence. So, as far as I'm concerned, I'm with Mark. They're doing a great job.
Thank you. I'll appreciate it. We'll pass that on at our department meeting.
Thanks, Chief. That was a great presentation. Do we need to break for a minute so people can use the restroom, or are we still okay?
Is there more on the agenda?
We're almost to the end. Somebody's sitting here crossing their legs. Maybe we need to stop for a second.
I have to break.
Okay.
I admit it.
Let's break for a couple minutes then. So, I don't want somebody to die here.
Are we adjourned here?
Just for a few minutes.
Too windy.
Just for a few minutes.
You're pretty quick, won't we?